KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
We've got music from every flavor, so keep it tuned on 91.9 on that FM dial where you can turn on, tune in, and jam out.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there, whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, March 17th, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebig with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Uro.
And longtime listeners of the show might know that I think we cover white fishes way too much, but this week I'm willing to make an exception for the lake whitefish as we talk about it in the context of the 100% Great Lakes Fish Initiative.
And we have two guests today. We've got Dave Napsker, who's the executive director and founder of the 100% Fish Pledge. And we've got Bill Bodine, who's the owner of Bodine Fisheries in Bayfield, Wisconsin.
I think we're going to have a really interesting conversation around lake whitefish and how to appreciate not just all the fish, which we've been covering for five seasons, but all of the fish. So warm welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, so since this is an audio show, we always like to start first with the fish of the week and what it looks like. If you were to have one of these fish in your hand, what would you see? What would it feel like? What do these fish look like?
Well, the lake whitefish on Lake Superior, speaking specifically our local fish here, is anywhere from 17 to 20 inches long. It's gray in color with beautiful scales, a mouth a little bit on the bottom of the nose, as it's a bottom feeder, and would weigh anywhere from 1.6 to about 2.2 pounds. If you go to the lower Great Lakes, they tend to grow a little bit bigger and are caught in larger mesh nets or seines. That's our typical fish here, is about a 2-pound, 19-inch fish.
Do you have anything to add?
It's a good basic description. The way I usually interact with them is by eating them, and they are a delicious, very mild fish. With a really nice texture and taste to them.
Awesome.
With so much coastline in the United States, I feel like a lot of people often forget about the Great Lakes and the commercial fisheries in them. So I'm curious if one or both of you could describe Great Lakes fisheries in general, specifically with respect to the whitefish, both maybe a historical perspective and what that looks like today.
We just got some updated figures, and right now the annual economic impact for the Great Lakes commercial fisheries is about $300 million. And it supports about 3,000 jobs across the entirety of the Great Lakes region, which stretches from Minnesota all the way over to New York and includes the Canadian province of Ontario. We do have a robust lake whitefish commercial fishery, and that's been the historic backbone of the commercial fishery. In recent years, there's been a significant decline, and other species have become a more and more important part of the mix, principally walleye, yellow perch, and lake trout. Other commercially caught species include white perch, white bass, and lake herring, which we usually refer to as Cisco. In addition to the commercial fishery, we've got a really important tribal fishery, and of course, a big sport fishery, which generates about $5 billion a year. So we've got a diverse fishery across the whole region, really important historically, very important to a lot of our rural communities, and an iconic part of what it means to be from the Great Lakes.
Bill, anything to add to that?
It's interesting because the Great Lakes are so large, great, magnificent, wonderful. We can keep going on. Superior being so much bigger than the others, as you've heard the stats, I think all the other Great Lakes plus several Lake Eries combined can go into Superior. We're happy to report that the whitefish population here has been stable and has not seen the decline that they're starting to see in Huron, Michigan specifically. So whitefish, I feel, is very well managed. You consider three states, two countries, and I believe there are 13 tribal nations headquartered along the shores of Lake Superior, and each of them are managing the species in their own area. And so it's highly regulated, it's very well controlled, and it's, again, it's very diverse just from one end of the state to the other.
Dave, you mentioned you know this fish very well through eating it and how good it tastes. What's the main way people consume this fish in this region of the Great Lakes?
Of course, you can have it any way you like it, but fried is kind of the iconic preparation, I would say. It's also popular, especially in northern Wisconsin, as part of a fish boil, where you get kind of a big cauldron of fish and potatoes and sometimes some other vegetables. We actually had this at the rehearsal dinner for my wedding, which was kind of a cool memory that we have in my family. And then they light off the top with some kerosene or something else that's flammable, and it all boils over and you kind of eat it all together. So a couple of different ways that people like it.
I kind of go into my Bubba Gump routine of how many different ways you could cook whitefish. But the Friday night fish fry across Wisconsin is, by and large, where the majority of it goes. I personally enjoy grilling it skin side down on aluminum foil on a grill outside and leaving that skin on the foil, and makes for easy cleanup and just tastes so wonderful. You can Cajun flavor it. You can put butter on it or Old Bay or any type of lemon pepper or dill and capers. But fish fries, whitefish BLTs.
Ooh.
All kinds of ways to do it. And then we haven't even talked about smoking it yet or making it into spreads.
So a ton of ways. And I asked that question because I was guessing it was mostly going to be the fillet, but I'm curious what this 100% pledge is and what that means exactly when it comes to this fish.
So we're working on thinking about our commercial fishery in a different way. What we've historically had has really been a fillet factory, effectively. People eat the fillet and the rest of the fish is either used for something of low value like animal feed or compost, or not at all and put into a landfill. And especially as we've seen declining lake whitefish catches throughout most of the Great Lakes, there has been a real need to try to look at ways to valorize or create value out of those other parts of the fish to support the fisheries, to support people that depend on them. We have been looking at a process over the last several years to look at what can we do with all those other parts of the fish, whether those are the heads or the frames or the viscera, the scales, whatever it may be. We kind of started from the standpoint of, well, what are the other parts of the fish that can be eaten? And we did a 100% head-to-tail fish challenge. We had a celebrity chef in Detroit who was asked to prepare lake whitefish, walleye, and lake trout. We had a fish head soup. We had a liver terrine. We had a salad that was made with the cheeks and some other parts of the fish. And it was a creative way to prepare some other parts of the fish that people don't often eat, but sometimes do. And to just show that even within the context of just food, there's so much more we can do if you use a little bit of imagination. There's a lot of nutrition there that you can capture, and some things that tasted really good too.
Amazing. I'm getting hungry.
Dave talked a little bit about the viscera. In our situation, the guts per se, they're really only piece of the viscera that's utilized in the lake whitefish is something called the whitefish liver, used basically as an appetizer, sauteed and cooked, much like chicken and beef liver, but it is a delicacy up here in many of the restaurants, sauteed with some peppers and onions and butter and little egg wash with it. The whitefish liver is one of those that we are already streaming out of the viscera in utilizing. We've been selling lake trout cheeks and utilizing that part of the head. I had some folks in this week buying heads to make their own soup stock and fish sauce out of some of what we would consider to be byproduct, but that's currently happening.
You kind of, with the way you said within the context of just food, it sort of implies that maybe there's some other ways to utilize these fish. I don't know if byproducts is the right term, especially now if you're actually making them into products, but what are some of the other things that you're looking into to be able to use these other parts of the fish?
I've been really lucky to work with some amazing partners internationally, principally the Iceland Ocean Cluster, but also some peers from around North America that are doing some really interesting things with different fish than we have here in the Great Lakes, but nevertheless have given us some great ideas and some great examples that we're in the process right now of exploring. Fish meal and oil is a pretty obvious opportunity where you can grind, dry, and prepare the material into a meal and oil product that can be sold as a global commodity for aquaculture feed, animal feed, fertilizers. Skin and scales can be used to produce collagen, which is becoming a more and more popular food additive for people that are health conscious. We're looking at making fish leather from the skins. I'm actually wearing my fish leather belt right now.
You have to show us.
Yeah, stand up.
It's Lake Whitefish, walleye, and lake trout. Depending on which direction you're looking at me, you'll see something a little bit different. But it's the second strongest type of leather after kangaroo, who knew? And it really is a cool, beautiful texture that creates something that's, I think, nice looking, but also kind of a great conversation starter.
Yeah, totally.
It's wondering what you're wearing around your waist. A few of the other things we're looking at, you know, kind of are a little bit more over the horizon. Nutraceuticals, medical bandages that can be made with skins. Mm-hmm. So things of that nature that are going to require a little bit more work. But near term, there's a lot of interesting possibilities. I should have also mentioned pet food and treats, which is something that's made commonly out of fish globally, but something we don't do a lot of here in North America. So that's a good growth opportunity.
Bill, how long have you been working in the Great Lakes? How many generations? And then how has this kind of changed the way that you've done business with just how you process things?
Well, the family has been fishing here since the 1880s, originally coming over from Sweden, and has been fishing and in the fish processing business largely since the 1920s. We've been in our current building here in Bayfield since 1960. And we're a fish processor. We're not only processing the fish that can be caught on our own license, but also from tribal and other state fishermen here in the Bayfield, Red Cliff, Bad River tribe of Native American Indians. So that we create more of the market and do more of the processing than necessarily going out and netting on a day-to-day basis. It puts us in a unique position of handling a lot of fish, a lot of volume. And with that, we created a lot of waste. There's a lot of fish that would go back into the local farms here that were being used as a fertilizer. But this last year, we put over 98,000 pounds into compost here in Ashland. Basically, by composting the byproduct right now, it goes out of our building as an expense. I feel that it's worth that investment because we're basically saving 70,000 pounds of carbon dioxide from not being released into the atmosphere. Number two is with Dave's 100% whitefish, if we can start to utilize the heads in the racks from our fillets and put those into collagen or fish meal instead of compost, that would be, if it's just pennies, we're talking about managing some of those little fractions of the fish processing here, that would be significant. I view the scales as being something beautiful. We've always thought that the scales, when they're cleaned out of the scaling machine, could be used as some type of a sparkle or a glitter, or even for sport fishing industry as a chum or a way to be able to sprinkle the water and show that there's action or some catching of the light that would attract sport fish.
What are racks when you say that term? I don't think we've heard that on the show before.
The rack is the backbone. When we put the fish through a fillet machine, it will create two sides of protein, and then the rack almost looks like a strip of bacon that comes through with the fat on the back, the backbone, and then the side rib trimming is a byproduct of that fillet machine.
Okay.
We've been looking for other places that would turn it into pet food. We're doing with our lake herring right now. Being able to do that on a whitefish would be another benefit.
Yeah, and just to scale up some of the numbers that Bill mentioned, we're really thrilled recently to be awarded the Seafood Industry Climate Award for our 100% fish work. Overall, commercial fisheries catch about 25 million pounds a year, and that generates about 15 million pounds of fish byproduct waste, or as I prefer to call it, raw material. Fish waste is a huge generator of methane gas, which is 25 times more potent than CO2. And it generates about 400 kilograms of carbon dioxide per ton equivalent. It overall is contributing significantly to air emissions from the region, which can be totally avoided by just simply moving it from a landfill, even to a compost situation, much less some of the other higher value products that we're taking a look at. The other issue that the region is facing is a lack of landfill space. There are estimates that within the next 5 to 10 years, the province of Ontario, for example, is going to run out of landfill space. So if we can be diverting millions of tons of fish raw material and convert that into products, you know, we can solve a couple of different problems all at once.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about the biotechnical testing that you guys do. What's the process like for doing R&D with these new products you're looking into? And then how are you guys funding that?
We've worked with two different labs. One is in Iceland, and it's called Morell. They have been a great partner and worked with us to help do a lot of this work. The other one is called Marinov, and they are based in Quebec. We have worked with commercial fish processors to take whole fish, and we've shipped them to these two research facilities. They effectively deconstruct the fish, separating out the collagen, the skin, the heads, the scales, the bones, different parts of the viscera, etc. And then they do a comprehensive, what we call biotechnical analysis. So they're looking at the content of each part, breaking down proteins, amino acids, lipids, ash content, things of that nature. And the reason that we're doing this analysis is because they are also experts at matching that with the commercial fish byproduct market. So they're able to take a look at our lake whitefish as an example and say, oh, the collagen that can be extracted from the skin and scales has a very attractive profile relative to what the international collagen market is looking for. And we've had some really interesting kind of unexpected discoveries. One of our tribes asked us to do biotechnical analysis on the white sucker, which is generally not a target species, but is a common bycatch species. And it actually had the most desirable protein profile of any of the fish that we
studied. There you go, white sucker. That's great.
Yeah. So for fish meal and oil and some of the other products where you want a high oil content and a particular mix of other attributes, you know, that may present a new commercial opportunity for one or more of the tribes or the commercial fishers that are catching them.
Yeah. Have you guys looked kind of at the whole suite of fish in the Great Lakes system? Or is this a kind of longer term goal to really get this ecosystem wide kind of approach for all the different species?
We started with the lake whitefish because of its importance throughout the whole region and also its status as kind of the historical backbone of the commercial fishery. From there, we expanded to look at the other three principal catch commercially caught species, which are walleye, yellow perch, and lake trout. We have also done testing on, as I mentioned, the white sucker, and then also the lake herring. So we've done commercial biotechnical testing on these six species. We can certainly look at others, but given the relative volumes of these fish compared to others, we think that's probably where the best commercial opportunities are likely to be.
I'm curious, Bill, what's the infrastructure? It sounds like you guys have your own processing facility. Also, how you might project differences in the level of development and infrastructure in other places, potentially limiting how other fishers, whether those be tribal people or people in less developed parts of the Great Lakes, being able to participate in this program.
Most of the fish that is being processed is in Wisconsin waters of Lake Superior, isolated to about four spots. And so there's a density within some of the state licensed fishermen as well as the tribal fishermen that have their own facilities that are doing the processing. Very few of the independent tribal fishermen are cutting the fish on their own boat per se in delivering to retail stores or restaurants. Some of that goes on, but most of it goes through the larger processing facilities. So we're catching the byproduct here on site and having the ability to then move that. I think the hurdle or obstacle is coming up with the economic model that allows the movement of this product to a facility. In where is that located? What central spot within the Great Lakes or within the Western Great Lakes should that be located in to kind of scale up the production of some of the product?
Yeah.
So that brings up a good point. I guess I'm curious, where do things currently stand with this project? Is it something that it's kind of theoretical, or are there real steps being taken to make sure that this is going to be something that's realistic?
We've been very structured in how we approached it. We first did the testing and we did some prototypes. We created some of the first fish leather that's been made out of yellow perch and whitefish and some of these other species, to kind of have a proof of concept and say it is possible to make a product out of these raw materials. We also created collagen and protein hydrolysates at the lab scale. So again, to prove that these biotechnical attributes do translate into a product, at least at the lab scale, that could be marketable. We more recently started a collaboration with a number of other partners. We're working with Trinidad Fishery Consultants out of the East Coast of Canada. We're working with the Ivy Business School at Western University in Ontario. We're working with the Sea Grant programs. We're also working with the states and the provinces and a number of other partners. And we're kind of midstream in this most recent phase of work. We began by doing a raw material supply map. So where is this material being generated? You heard from Bill about what happens at his facility. What does that look like scaled out to the whole region? And we have an interactive map. You can check it out on our website if you're interested, where you can see these kind of clusters of supply, one of them being in Bill's neck of the woods. Next, we did a demand analysis, both at the regional level, North American, and also the global level, because we want to think about what markets are growing and where might there be a demand for the material that we're generating. We next are in the process of doing a value chain analysis to say, if you wanted to make pet food and treats, for example, from this raw material to meet this demand, where are the existing entities that can take this supply? Or if you were going to need to create a new facility or a new partnership or something along those lines, what are some of those issues and challenges? And that really helps to kind of drill down on what are the best near-term opportunities for the region. Next, we'll be doing an environmental and economic benefits analysis. So this is to say, if I wanted to activate a pet food and treats opportunity or a fish meal and oil opportunity or whatever the case might be, how does that look economically? And then how does that look environmentally? You know, if we're transporting things crisscrossing the region 10 times, it's going to have a little different profile than if it can be processed locally. And then last, we're going to do recommendations to government. Our governors and premiers get together every 2 years. And this October, they'll be meeting in Quebec City. And at that time, we'll be presenting all of this to them and hopefully announcing an exciting next phase of work where we're going to be activating these opportunities and helping to connect people that are looking for a very cool and profitable investment opportunity connected to something that is going to have a positive environmental, economic, and social outcome for places all over the region.
That's great. Right. Do you have any sense of kind of how the public feels about this great reduction in waste and all these different kind of neat products that can come out of this?
We haven't really done direct public outreach like we have with some of our other projects in terms of convening public meetings and things like that, but have talked to a lot of different audiences and we've done a lot of media and press. So I think based on all of that, we've seen a very positive response. People kind of, at first instance, a little bit puzzled, like, what's the problem and why are we doing all this? But then when they come to understand it, I think almost universally, either coming at it from primarily an economic or an environmental point of view to say, how can we accelerate this and how can we make this happen more quickly? Yeah. So with that kind of a response and with work yet to be done, we're very optimistic on what we think we can accomplish in the next several years. And we've appreciated the patience for Bill and a lot of the other producers who we started talking about this with them a few years ago. And I think complicated problems take a little time to solve. We're moving quickly, I think, all things considered. But we know that there's a lot of people who are real eager to see things happening on the ground. And that's really our challenge for this next phase.
Yeah, I think people would be just surprised how much waste there is along with fisheries, even globally. I mean, it's probably just astronomical and you go to the store and you see just your fish fillet in there, but all the kind of back end of how that gets there, I would be surprised if people are aware of that. So I think that's neat.
Yeah, and typically for a fish, you know, from the Great Lakes or otherwise, about 40 to 60% is the fillet and the rest is often determined to be, you know, waste or in our case, raw material.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved in this, Bill? Did David reach out to you or did you read about it?
I remember reading about it and seeing some of the success that originally showed up in the Iceland cod market in terms of protein sales value to what the overall market then was able to create from the waste or the byproduct in developing some of the other products. It was a no-brainer on our side. We've been capturing in not sending things to a landfill, but sending it through compost already. But if we could take that a step further and kind of switch that from being an expense side to an asset side or a sales side of, in even just capturing what had been an expense or minimizing that to a degree, we see the benefit of it. when I was approached, it was, I think, through the Michigan Fish Producers Association, kind of a Great Lakes state organization that represents the larger part of the commercial fisheries in the Great Lakes. And that was just something that I was excited to be able to say, yeah, we will easily support that and provide leather from the different fish that we've provided to the gentleman that's making the fish leather belts and cell phone holders and money clips and the different things that can be done with those things. And samples of product and or smoked fish for events or whatever we could do. So it's been a good partnership.
That's great. I was just going to ask Dave what's your background is in. What kind of topics did you study in school? I'm guessing, maybe, I don't know, are you a traditional fish biologist type, or what's your background in?
To tag on to that question too, if you could also wrap in what the Great Lakes governors and premiers, I don't really know much about that organization is too. So why don't you talk about what your background is? I'd love to hear what this organization is that you're with and what they do.
So I'm a relative latecomer to the fish industry, a happy latecomer, but a latecomer nevertheless. I have been with the Conference of Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Governors for about 20 years, and the organization focuses on regional economic development and environmental protection, and there are a range of projects focused on export promotion and tourism marketing, protecting the waters of the Great Lakes, and a number of others. One of my jobs as the executive director is to come up with new ideas and bring them to the governors as opportunities. I had a very happy accident a number of years ago. I was traveling to Europe and had a layover in Iceland for a few days and did some research about different things that were happening in the country that might be interesting that we could learn from. I discovered the Iceland Ocean Cluster that was working on valorizing 100% of the Icelandic cod catch. They, similar to our lake whitefish of recent years, have been suffering from a big collapse in the stocks of the Icelandic cod, especially looking back, 20 years or so. While they were looking at strategies to replenish those stocks, there was a parallel effort that said, how can we do more with whatever the amount of fish we're catching? So at the time, they were using about 40% of each fish, that was the fillet, and it generated about $12. Over a decades-long exercise of working to identify these new product opportunities, they're now using upwards of 90% of each fish, and the value that you can generate from the material from just a single Icelandic cod is now about $5,000. So that's not all money that goes into the pocket of the fishermen. However, it's all related to the fish industry, and the fish industry is now generating far more value than it used to, even though they're catching a fraction of the fish.
That is a good lesson for us here, that I think a lot of times that value is untapped in a lot of things, like the value of clean water, the value of all these really neat native fish that we have. So that's awesome.
When I started, shopping this idea around to the commercial fish industry, we heard a lot of interest similarly from the resource managers that work with the states and the provinces and the tribes. And I was kind of scratching my head to a question you asked earlier, Guy, which was, how are we paying for all of this? This work doesn't happen for free. We've been very fortunate. We've gotten grants in the amount of about $500,000 so far and counting. That's come from the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, which is our U.S.-Canadian resource management agency. It's come from the Great Lakes Fishery Trust, which is a charitable organization that makes grants for issues related to the fishery. We've gotten money from the Ontario Commercial Fisheries Association, which of course has a very direct interest in the work. And as I mentioned earlier, we recently got the Seafood Industry Climate Award, and that came with a cash prize from the Acme Smoked Fish Foundation. So bundling that all together has made all this work possible. And I just submitted a proposal to the Small Business Administration to formalize our cluster. And one of the services we're interested in would be to collaborate with these other groups around the rest of North America. So like the Alaska Food Marketing Institute does some work that's kind of related. There's an Oregon Ocean Cluster that's working on the Oregon coast. There's a New Bedford Ocean Cluster and another on the U.S. East Coast where there's a concentration of a number of different companies that historically have been disconnected from one another, but that are all connected to a single industry and can actually benefit by collaborating. We're all kind of going through this process, fits and starts, and if we would be able to better learn from each other in terms of how to tackle these issues, create some centralized resources to help do the testing and knowledge transfer and all that, we're all going to be a lot more successful. And it's not something where we're necessarily competing with one another if rising tide lifts all ships in this case, because we can meet growing demand and create supply that's, you know, desperately needed for almost all of these products. If you can show that they all are going to benefit, that's something that can become magnetic over time. So the Small Business Administration helps to support these kinds of organizations. We don't have one for fish here in our region. And so we're exploring whether or not that would be something that would be of value to kind of extend this beyond just the work of the governors and the premiers to become something that could be broader, more collaborative, and connect with some of these kind of adjacent industries.
Right on. Bill, I'm curious, in your perspective as a man on the water, what value beyond simple economic value does having actively working fisheries on the waterfront in these communities provide?
Well, first of all, there's a large tourist component, and having the tourism industry embrace Bayfield from May through October is just a benefit. Not only does it bring additional people into the area, but the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore is headquartered here with 21 of the 22 Apostle Islands in that national lakeshore and some of the mainland area. So it's a haven for sailors, for kayakers, just a tremendous vacation destination. In having a viable commercial fishing industry, again, if you think of the numbers, what percentage of people catch their own fish for consumption versus who depends on a commercial fisheries to provide that fish via a grocery store or a retail fish market? Surprisingly, there's a strong sport fishing in the area of Lake Superior, but majority of the people rely on a commercial fisherman to bring that fish to the market for them. As tourists are in the area, having a fresh Friday night fish fry, sit down restaurant, and seeing these iconic looking boats or tugs, enclosed halls, windows, doors, the portals, the lifters coming out of the side. It's an intriguing harbor front for them to walk through and take pictures and paint and just embrace the shoreline of Bayfield and Cornucopia, any of the other large fishing villages around the Great Lakes.
One of the things that I really love about fisheries is that they are one of the few industries that have this really tight connection with the physical geography and biology of the location where they are. And so looking forward, like if there's some way that you could get specifically like, oh, these leather belts and then like sell leather belts and sell leather wallets in the fish market where you are that say like this specifically came from here, I got to imagine that people would love that. I would certainly love that.
And they would eat that up, wouldn't they?
I would.
They would.
We do have some that are doing it now. We have connected some of the fish processors that have retail locations with Fisker Leather, which is the one that made the belt. And some of them are selling products at their retail shops right now. It's not just the t-shirt or the koozie or whatever you expect to see. It's something, you know, this is a product made by hand from my fish, which, like you said, Guy, people think is pretty cool.
Is there some product from them we could like put in cell phones or the electronic business or something?
Cell phone covers with fish leather.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, even when you sit on your wallet for a long drive, it doesn't smell like fish.
Well, that's good. I was curious what you both would like to see in, say, the next 5 years and 50 years for the region in terms of how consumers think about fish and respecting the whole fish and all of the raw materials.
It's a good question. And I think it relates to valuing something that we've historically looked at as waste. Even the term, you know, suggests it's garbage, it's worthless, it's something to be disposed of. I'll never forget when we had some of our Icelandic counterparts come to visit, and they were at one of the processing facilities and seeing this material go onto the ground and ultimately into the waste stream. Thor Sigfusson, the head of the Iceland Ocean Cluster, got down on his knees and picked up this material with his bare hands and said, "I cannot believe you're throwing this away. This is the most valuable part of the fish." In the Icelandic experience, that material is generating $4,900 roughly, whereas the fillet, the historic valuable part of the fish, is only generating about $10. So you can really flip things on their head if you think about them a little bit differently. I don't know how important it really is for the average person or consumer to totally understand that, but I think it is important for the industry and government and those of us that are closer to it to really rethink how we're approaching all of this, because we can turn this problem, this cost, into an opportunity and a profit center with a little bit of imagination and a little heart.
Yeah.
The short term is 5 years from now is being able to have some of the byproduct that we're creating start to generate some revenue along that stream, knowing that we can ultimately pay more to the fishermen for their catch, but then be able to have a little more profitability in the industry all the way through the chain by the creation of some of the markets for these other products. Technology, if we use this right, and we have to, our world depends on that, is getting more out of less and being able to utilize everything that's being caught and putting it to good use as opposed to creating other products that have to take that place. I think we just need to continue valuing the whole fish and creating some of those markets and appreciating what we've had, but just evolving with the technology and the times.
I love that.
If people want to learn more about this whole initiative, or if they are in the industry and want to get involved, how can they learn more or get in touch with y'all?
We have a lot of information on our website. It's www.gsgp.org. All of the technical reports I mentioned are available there. The raw material supply map is there. The 100% Great Lakes Fish Pledge is there with all the signatory company logos and a lot of other information. You can also find contact information for us. So if anyone wants to connect, please don't hesitate.
And I think a note to just anglers, like maybe even recreational anglers out there, there's probably a lot of neat ways you can be utilizing more just on your own at a very much smaller scale, but useful nonetheless, eating the liver, checking out the cheeks, just trying to reduce that waste kind of one fish at a time.
Katrina cooks up the milt sacks from her salmon that she catches.
Yep, salmon tenders. They look just like a chicken tender, but they taste a little bit different. They're very good.
We've got some people looking at that for lake herring, Cisco.
Okay.
Also, swim bladders can have value. They're used as a very high-end adhesive and in document restoration.
Who knows? Oh.
But you can get the swim bladders. And I don't recall exactly the pricing, but someone told me it was somewhere on the order of the value of gold.
Wow.
Now, you probably have to harvest an awful lot of swim bladders to get an ounce, but nevertheless.
Yeah.
When we're processing herring this fall, David, let me know who's buying. I'll start snipping them.
That's awesome. I think I'm biased, but I think fish have potential to be like our most valuable commodity in the U.S. I think what you guys are doing is just great.
The world is desperate for good proteins and new sources of cool products. So we can look to a historical industry to help meet that need, that would be terrific.
Well, this has been super cool conversation. This is super neat. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us on. Appreciate it.
We'll get out there and live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish in their entirety, especially the lake whitefish.
Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Uro. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset. Starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the National Weather Service of Anchorage, Alaska. From Sidkenap to Castle Cape, small craft advisory through Tuesday. Today, east winds 25 knots, sea 6 feet with rain and snow. Tonight, northeast winds 30 knots, seas 9 feet with rain and snow. And Tuesday, north winds 25 knots, seas 7 feet. Castle Cape to Cape Tolstoy, small craft advisory tonight and Tuesday. Today, north winds 20 knots, seas 6 feet with rain and snow. Tonight, north winds 30 knots, seas 6 feet with freezing spray. And Tuesday, north winds 25 knots, seas 6 feet with freezing spray. Cape Tolstoy to Cape Sarashef, gale warning tonight. Today, northwest winds 15 knots, becoming north 30 in the afternoon, seas 7 feet. Tonight, north winds 35 knots, seas 7 feet with freezing spray. And Tuesday, north winds 30 knots, becoming northwest 20 in the afternoon, seas 6 feet with freezing spray. Port Hedden and Nelson Lagoon, small craft advisory through Tuesday. Today, northeast winds 30 knots, seas 8 feet. Tonight, north winds 30 knots, seas 9 feet with freezing spray. And Tuesday, northwest winds 25 knots, diminishing to 15 in the afternoon, seas 7 feet with freezing spray. Nelson Lagoon to Cape Sarashef, small craft advisory through Tuesday. Today, northeast winds 25 knots, seas 4 feet, building to 8 in the afternoon. Tonight, north winds 30 knots, seas 9 feet with freezing spray. And Tuesday, north winds 25 knots, diminishing to 15 in the afternoon, seas 8 feet with freezing spray. Your detailed forecast for the Alaska Peninsula. Today, cloudy. A chance of rain and snow in the morning, then a chance of snow in the afternoon. Areas of blowing snow in the afternoon. Highs in the lower 30s to lower 40s. North winds 10 to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of snow in the evening, then partly cloudy after midnight. Areas of blowing snow. Lows 15 to 25. North winds 15 to 30 miles per hour with gusts to 45. And Tuesday, mostly sunny. Areas of blowing snow in the morning. Highs in the lower 20s to lower 30s. Northwest winds 10 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 40 in the morning. Your tide predictions for the Popoff Island. There was a high tide at 4:34 a.m. at 7 foot 3 inches. A low at 11:08 a.m. at 6 inches. A high at 5:19 p.m. at 5 foot 10 inches. And a low tonight at 10:46, a tide of 2 feet 1 inch. Your sun rose at 8:50 this morning, and your sun will set at 8:50, giving us 12 hours of daylight. And that was your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset here on KSDP and KAEB. I'm Amy Mack. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Tim Rocky. Alaska's State Development Agency says it's talking with the operator of the Ketchikan shipyard to resolve a dispute that threatens the future of the key local employer. That comes about 2 weeks after the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, told shipyard operator Vigor that it would not renew its contract to run the multimillion-dollar state facility. ADA said Vigor had not supported enough jobs, made enough money for the state, or adequately contributed to repairs and maintenance. The agency said the operator's time at the shipyard would end November 30th. Now, though, tensions appear to be easing. A joint statement from ADA and Vigor says the two are, quote, united in their commitment to preserving this essential shipyard. Both say they're working together on ways to extend their working relationship by exploring new opportunities to better serve the state's maritime needs. Neither side offered any details on what had changed in the meantime. Previously, ADA said it was willing to discuss extending the end of the contract to March of next year, but there's no mention of the March deadline in a statement from Thursday indicating the pair may be negotiating a longer-term deal. ADA and Vigor say they're optimistic about the shipyard's future and its enduring role in the region. They say they'll provide further updates in the near future as negotiations continue. Alaska's state ombudsman is resigning in April. Kate Burkhart leaves after 8 years on the job and countless investigations that have led to major systemic reforms in the state. The ombudsman is a nonpartisan position within the state that serves as part of the checks and balances for the government. The office investigates systemic and individual complaints of state agencies and makes recommendations on how to fix them. In an interview last week, Burkhart says she's proud of the work she and her staff have accomplished during her tenure.
Government touches people's lives every day, whether they realize it or not. And for a lot of people, it touches their lives in some of the most intimate ways possible. The Ombudsman's Office, we are able to connect people to the folks in government who can solve their problem. And then if for whatever reason that doesn't happen, then we can investigate to figure out what happened, why it happened, and what can be done to fix it.
Burkhart will leave Juneau for Maine to be closer to family. She took a job as the director of Maine's Bureau of Labor Standards for the Department of Labor. The state of Alaska created its ombudsman's office 5 decades ago, and Alaska is one of only 5 states that have a statewide ombudsman. Assistant Ombudsman Jacob Carball will serve as acting ombudsman until the Alaska legislature appoints a permanent replacement. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
Matson, delivering the essentials for everyday life in the last frontier. Learn more at matson.com/Alaska.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Tim Rocky. Jesse Holmes won his first Iditarod Trail sled dog race Friday morning on the race's longest trail in history. Alaska Public Media's Ava White reports.
Holmes and his 10-dog team, led by Polar and Hercules, pulled onto Front Street in Nome just before 3 a.m. Friday. The early morning arrival and temperatures hovering around 0 degrees didn't stop hundreds of people from cheering him on and celebrating his win. This year's trail was the longest ever, clocking 1,128 miles, and Holmes' team finished it in 10 days, 14 hours, and 56 minutes. It was the longest time it's taken a champion to reach Nome in over 2 decades. Holmes says he's been waiting for this moment for years.
I have nothing to stop smiling about. You know, I have everything going for me, and I should never feel a down moment in my life. If I died tomorrow, I'd just die the happiest man.
Holmes walked down his line of dogs, petting them and throwing them raw steaks as a celebratory treat. He jumped into the crowd to hug his fans, who had lined up for over an hour waiting for his arrival. Holmes is originally from Alabama and now lives in interior Alaska, where he says he works as a carpenter. He starred on the reality TV show Life Below Zero. He notched his first Iditarod victory on his 8th try and says he's full of emotion.
But it was incredible seeing everybody out and the energy and just knowing that I made so many people proud that believed in me, you know. I think that's the most rewarding feeling of it all.
Holmes wins an Iditarod notable for its long trail after scarce snow in south-central Alaska forced race organizers to reroute it to Fairbanks. Plus, its small race field, the number of starting mushers, just 33, tied with a record low. And it had a close game of leapfrog. For much of the race, Holmes, Matt Hall, and Paige Drobny traded first place. They were all chasing their first Iditarod win. They all live in the interior and all have come close to winning before. Holmes said he and Hall have been friends for decades. The two met in Eagle, a village on the Yukon River, where they worked at Hall's father's trap line. At one point when they saw each other on the trail this year, Holmes says he yelled out.
I yelled across the ice. I was on a parallel trail. I go, man, 16 years ago in Eagle, can you believe this? Like, here we are, we're leading the Iditarod. And, like, it was a real cool moment between us.
This was a banner year for interior mushers, and it involved a whole lot of love at the finish line. Holmes came back out to the Burled Arch as Hall and his 10 dogs dashed in to secure second place for the second year in a row. Dozens of people cheered on Hall, including his wife Elke, who he immediately kissed.
Gorgeous. Hey, gorgeous.
Hey.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Sled dogs Dai and Kivik led the team in. Hall was raised on the Yukon River, which much of the Iditarod Trail followed. Still, he says the trail this year went on for far too long and included a loop on the river that felt endless. Hall told the Iditarod Insider in an interview played over loudspeakers at the finish that he remembers his thinking.
Oh no, more Yukon, and more, and more. And then this part, we gotta go back on it again.
Holmes and Hall were both back at the finish line later Friday morning to congratulate Drobny for her third place arrival. As Drobny and her dogs raced in, her friends and family chanted in shiny hula skirts wearing flower leis around their necks while doing a kick line.
Okay. Now, 1, 2, 3, go!
Hey, chase Drobny! Hey, chase Drobny!
Drobny didn't sign up for the Iditarod until a couple months before it started, but she said her dogs deserve to be here. In Nome, I'm Ava White.
This is Alaska Public Media.
It's a beautiful morning.
Good morning, everybody out here in southeast Alaska, and happy St. Patrick's Day. Yes, indeed. Another day in paradise, and got St. Patrick's to celebrate it with us. And I'm just in time to announce a song that'll take us to the top of the hour, and I'll be back at 10. We have Sit Down by the Fire, the Pogues, will take us all the way to the top of the hour, it looks like. And we have, after Sit Down on the Fire, we have the Broad Majestic Shannon, and then the Irish Rover, all coming at you.
Sit down by the fire, I'll tell you a story, send you away to fight. Things are creeping whenever you're sleeping, you wish you were out instead. It isn't the mice in the wall, it isn't the wind in the well. Every night they pretend that all in one, on the way out of hell. Damn, I see you sleep when you wake up screaming. The colonies are funny, you're down the brain. They live in a snoring of trees in the hell, laughing at the top of the wind. And it dance in the rain, it dance in the wind, the top of the window when no one is in. And where you see them, pretend that you're down at the point of your head. And wherever you live, and dance to your neck, they dance to your head. And they dance to your chest, they give you the kind of chronic but just. We'll
and sunburned tears in her cheeks. She sang me a song that was pure as the breeze, and her own leading up Glenavie. I sat for a while at the crescent finner where young lovers would meet when the flowers were in bloom. Heard the men coming from the finner at Chiron, their hearts in Tipperary, wherever they go. Take my hand and dry your tears, babe. Take my hand, forget your fears, babe. There's no pain, there's no more sorrow. They've all gone, gone in the years, babe. Sat for a while by the gap in the wall, found a rusty tin can and an old hurdy ball. When the cards been dealt and the rolls are recalled, and a fiddle playing chandon and all. And the next time I see you, we'll down at the Greeks. There'll be whiskey and Sunday and tears in our cheeks. We're stupid to laugh and it's useless to fall, but a rusty tin can and all our evil. Your fears, babe. There's no pain, there's no more sorrow. They're all gone, gone in the years, babe. So I walked as day was dawning, where small birds sang and leaves were falling. Where we once watched the robots landing and the bright majestic shine.
Set sail from the sweet home of Cork. We were sailing away with a cargo of bricks for the Grand City Hall in New York. 'Twas a wonderful craft, she was rigged for the laugh. You know how the wild wind drove her. She stood several blasts, she had 27 masts, and they called her the Irish Rover.
We had 1 million bags of the best loyal rags. We had 2 million barrels of stone. We had 3 million sides of our blind horses' hides. We had 4 million barrels of bones. We had 5 million hogs, 6 million doves, 7 million barrels of porter. We had 8 million piles of old Nanny Goss tiles and a horn of the Irish Rover.
There was help, Mickey Coote, who played hard on his flute when the ladies lined up for the set. He was tooting with skill for each sparkling quadrille till the dancers were fluter and bet. With his smart, witty talk, he was cock of the walk as he rolled the dame under and over. They all knew at a glance when he took up his stance and he sailed in the Irish.
Of the leader was holding from Kelsey to home. There was Johnny McGurk, who was scared stuff of work, and I'm a